Oak Session number 12049, Reel 3.
Mr. Meninsky, Reel 3.
Once we got into the really unpleasant part of our prison life, when men were very ill, dying in their hundreds, literally, it was amazing how those that were well and able to do so looked after their chums. I mean, I was extremely ill for about 6 months. I had malaria, I had this ulcer on my ankle and I couldn't walk. I developed pleurisy right in the middle of it. I'd got very, very pellagra. I mean, you know, one wonders how you survive those things. But George Old, the artist, used to come every day to the hut, to the camp, which was the hospital section, and he bathed me, fed me, looked after me. And this applied everywhere. I mean, it was just a common sight to see fellows nursing men. And they couldn't have been more gentle and loving to them if they'd been related to them or married to them, if you like. I mean, the amount of humanity and care which was extended from one man to another was incredible. And that's what lives with me more than anything else.
Now, the artists that you were mentioning, how did you first meet them?
Well, it's all started, actually, in the name of the camp. Well, I met Ronald Searle and George Old. We all met in Singapore, in Changi, because when the theatre started, there was an appeal for artists to help with the decor and things like that. And George Old was in the Foresters. He was the best artist of us all. Unfortunately, I don't think you have any of his work because the Japanese discovered it. Unlike myself, I handed mine over to the medical authorities and they looked after it. George kept his and the Japs found it and confiscated it. And although he got home after the war, he didn't live for very long. But I met George there, Ronald Searle, who did the most marvellous drawings, as you know, you've got a lot of them. What happened to Bob Brazil and Jack Chalker's drawings, I don't know whether you have any of those, but we got to know each other in Changi, and once we went up country, I was together with Ronald Searle for a while and George Old, but I was always in the same camps as George Old. We always moved together, so we retained, and indeed so did Jack Chalker, we retained this friendship. And what we used to do, I mean, people have said to me on a number of occasions, where did you get your materials from? Well, we all did a bit of looting. Most of us had some materials with us anyway. But I had an extraordinary stroke of luck, which is an interesting point, actually. When we were working in Singapore, we moved from Changi, a large number of us, to River Valley Road, and we went out on working parties doing all sorts of jobs. And one of the jobs that we were doing was at the General Hospital. We were clearing up the debris because they were using it as a hospital for Japanese troops. And while I had a working party there, and we were clearing away sandbags, actually. And one day I noticed an artist, a Japanese artist, sitting drawing a soldier, one of our fellows. And I watched him working, and he was an extremely talented man. And I noticed an interesting thing. He drew, over the next few days, he drew probably a half a dozen of our chaps, but he always drew people with tattoos on. He always chose people with tattoos, whether they sort of used this as a sort of propaganda thing to say that we were a wild race that all wore tattoos or not, I don't know. However, he suddenly noticed that I was watching him a lot, and he called me over, and he spoke quite good English. And he said, you are interested? And I said, yes, I am. You draw? And I said, I did. He said, tomorrow you will draw me. Well, I was in some trepidation because I thought, goodness me, you know, if I make a bad job of this, what's going to happen? However, he brought paper and charcoal, and I did a drawing of him. And it was a good drawing, and it was very like him, and he was delighted with it. So the following day when he came back, he bought me a supply of paper, he bought me a small box of watercolours, he bought me some pens, some ink, some Chinese ink, and some pencils. Well, we then had to make up our minds, once the doctors had suggested that we might keep some records, what was the best way to approach this? Obviously, intelligently, one would give them to them to look after. On the other hand, there was always the possibility that someone would catch you drawing and wonder why you were doing it. So we decided together that we would paint openly, but we would paint things that would be a natural thing for someone to paint, like a flower or a butterfly. Now, the Japanese love paintings of things like butterflies and flowers. And there was a sergeant in charge of the hut that I was in River Valley Road, who was an extremely cultured man and a charming man. And he was always coming and bringing a flower and saying, will you paint this for me? Not in those words, but presenting it to you. And you'd paint it for him, and he never gave you money, always gave you materials. He had the intelligence to realise that was important. Well, he would give you an odd packet of cigarettes and some peanut toffee or something. But he would always pay you in kind. And so we accumulated quite a collection of material between us. The other thing which we found very, very useful, and I used a great deal, was the brushes that came on the iodine bottles, because we still had some bottles of iodine. And attached to each one was a brush. And would you, it's quite amusing when you think of it now. Do you know they were sable brushes, pure sable, those brushes. Cost a fortune if you buy them now. So one way or another, we had accumulated quite a collection of material. The Japanese were aware we were painting, but they thought of us as painting flowers, butterflies, local fauna and flora, you know. But it did mean that they were not unaccustomed to seeing material lying around. On the other hand, once you'd completed a drawing of, say, an ulcer or something of that nature, then I always, and we all did, except George, we passed them on to the doctors and they looked after them and kept them. In fact, a lot of them went back to Australia and a lot of them are still there. I was always wondering what happened to some of my drawings, and I don't know if you're aware of it, but I'm sure you must be, that there was a book published in a couple of years ago called The War Diaries of Weary Dunlop. And I discovered 15 of my drawings that had gone missing were used to illustrate it. And there's Chalker drawings in there too, and various other people.
Why did George Oldnut do the same?
I don't know. He was George was one of them. He was certainly the finest draftsman I've ever met in my life. I mean, George could draw absolutely anything. He taught me so much, that man. He'd been a commercial artist before the war, and he, as far as I know, maybe Major Moon or Colonel Dunlop took a few of his drawings, but I can't believe they did, because they haven't appeared in that book. He had this thing about wanting to hold on to what he did. I've got two drawings of his upstairs. I've got a small painting of a hut in moonlight and a drawing of me, which he gave me. But just about 6 months before the war ended, we had a search, and we didn't get any warning, which was unusual. And they found all his work, and they took it away. And he was absolutely heartbroken, I mean, you can imagine. I mean, I said to him, we've told you so often, this is ridiculous to keep these things. He was a most extraordinary man. He was highly intelligent, wonderful draftsman, terrific company, just an amazing man. And he looked exactly like Van Gogh. He had a red beard, and if you want to think what George looked like, he looked like Van Gogh. And when the war finished, we went through to Rangoon, and a colonel whose name I can't remember, who was in charge of the Indian hospital there, asked George Old and myself to stay on to do a series of drawings which he was going to use at the war criminal trials. And he said what he wanted us to do. And we drew some thin men, and we painted a lot of... I don't know what happened to these. They just disappeared. A lot of skin conditions where you can get better idea of what the condition is with the watercolour than you can with a photograph, because you can be more accurate. I was... One of the jobs I did was do a painting of a liver which was pitted with some sort of terrible disease, which really took me all my time to sort of do, I can assure you. And George worked there, and certainly that work should have been still in existence, but where it's gone, I don't know. I can't remember this man's name. If I sat and thought about it, I would remember it, and if I do, I will phone you up and tell you. But he was going to the war criminal trials with evidence, and some of the evidence were the drawings we were doing. So he had those drawings of Olds, but apart from that, he lost everything he did.
Why was he such good company?
He had a fantastic sense of humour. I mean, he was a terribly funny man. He, this is something, of course, which also one remembers very vividly, was that there was always somebody, under the worst circumstances you could imagine, would say something. It would generally be a Glaswegian or a Cockney who would say something that would make you laugh. And I can remember vividly when we were going up through the jungle to the camp at Tarsal, where we built a camp, and it was the monsoon time, and it was terribly difficult to sort of go through these elephant tracks because they were just thick with mud. And I was very fit in those days. I still kept fit. And George wasn't too fit, and he kept trudging along, and we became very straggled. And there was this particular occasion when he slipped and fell, and I went back to help pick him up. And he was a big man. He was about 6'3". And as I was picking him up, his weight was too much for me, and he pulled me down. And neither of us could get up. I mean, every time you try to get a foothold, you slipped. And we finished up so collapsed with laughter, we became weak from laughter. I mean, under those circumstances, it's crazy. But George would always find something to say at the worst possible moment, which would make everybody laugh. He wasn't the sort of man that was the party wit. He wasn't like that. He had a natural, droll sense of humour. And he was a wonderfully kind man. That was the other thing. I mean, he would do anything to help anybody. He was a delightful man, actually.
What was it that he particularly taught you?
He taught me a great deal about drawing. He wouldn't so much as give you a drawing lesson by taking the thing away from you and the pencil away from you and demonstrating, although he did so much drawing, one was learning by looking. But he would say to you, why don't you try this, and why don't you look at it this way, and so on. And a comment he once passed about drawing from the shadows, which sounds almost as it would mean nothing, but I quickly grasped what he meant, and he taught me a great deal about drawing and encouraged me all the time. A couple of watercolours that I did actually in Changi, little landscapes, he took them and kept them. He said, I'm never going to part with these. I don't know what's happened to them, of course, now. He was a natural teacher.
Was it just an inborn talent on his part?
Oh, no, he'd been trained. He trained at Camberwell School of Art, and I think he'd been to the Royal College as well. But he'd been a commercial artist before the war, and he had made up his mind that when he came home, he wasn't going to go back into commercial art, he was going to become a fine artist. But it didn't transpire because he didn't live very long after he got home, unfortunately. He died, so...
Can you tell me what your memories are of Ronald Searle in the camps?
Yes, I can. We're still in touch, of course. We write to each other. I first met Ronald at the back of the theatre, and he was doing some posters for a show we put on called Men Only. And Ronald has an extraordinary sense of humour. I mean, he's a unique person. I've never met anybody else quite like him. He doesn't ever really laugh. You probably remember, I mean, he was a cartoonist. He did the St. Trinian's Girls and things of that nature, which required an enormous sense of humour to create, and his work's gone on like that. And he had the drollest sense of humour. He would make other people laugh, and the most you ever got from Ronald was a smile. And I can remember an instance, actually, which is a rather cruel one in a way. But we used to work together in a room behind the theatre. There was an actual theatre in Changi, and there was four or five of us working there, and there was a young subaltern, I think from the Norfolks, who was one of those people who had no artistic talent of his own, but he rather liked to mix with people that did, and he used to come up. And he was almost... It was almost as if he'd come out of a book of the period, because he would tell us stories about what went on in his own life at home, and he was always talking about Mummy, you see. And Mummy said this, and we had this tea party, and so-and-so came, and Mummy didn't really like them very much, you know. And it was like a character out of a play, more than reality. And there was one occasion when he told us a long, boring story, and he didn't add the bit about what Mummy said. And suddenly, across the room came Ronald Searles, and what did Mummy say? Which was actually cruel. But, I mean, we all tried not to laugh, and we were all sort of getting down to our drawing and pretending it wasn't happening, you know. And, you know, it went right over his head, this fellow. But that was a sort of droll sense of humour that he had, which he never lost, even though he became extremely ill, like a lot of us. It was always there. And it's still there. It's still the same. I mean, he writes to me, and his letters are always very funny. When I had my last exhibition, I got a telegram on the opening night, and it said, and it was all dancers from the ballet, and it said something like, May you play to a full house and finish the evening on a grand pirouette or something like that. You know, it was that sense of humour never leaves him.
Was there a difference between the kind of subjects he tackled from those that you did?
Yes, there was, in actual fact. He did a lot of drawings of the Japanese soldiers. I don't know whether you've noticed that in the collection you have. Was I never did. I occasionally would put a Jap in when he was part of the scene, but, I mean, I didn't actually draw them... Well, once or twice I did when they asked me to, and I had very little option but to do it, but I didn't make drawings of them to keep. He did draw them quite a lot, actually. Some of his... I don't know what you have in your collection. I'd love to see them all. The first drawing I ever saw of Searles, which... was of what was actually happening on the island. It was one of the most incredible drawings I think I've ever seen. It was a drawing of a cart, a bullock cart, loaded up with dead Chinese. Maybe you've got the drawing. And it was very sparse, the drawing. I mean, I shouldn't think you could have taken one line out. I mean, it was the minimum number of lines, but my God, it was graphic. I mean, you could feel these horrific deaths, sort of hands sticking out, and, you know, these incredible draftsmen. But treated art in a different way to George. George had a very serious feel about the fine arts, whereas Ronald Searles never ever talked like that. He was just a draftsman, really. Incredible draftsman. A little story, it's an aside really, but when I came home and my father saw my drawings that I brought home, he said, I've made a mistake, but it's not too late, you're still young enough to sort of do, which I did, do something about it. But he said to me, by the way, he said, my father then was teaching at Central Schools, and he said, I had an application to join the school from somebody called Sewell? Ronald Searles. And I said, no, Ronald Searles. I said, he's a great friend of mine. He said, well, I don't think much of his drawing, so I didn't take him. But Ronald's never held it against me, I'm pleased to say. He was such a different sort of draftsman to what my father thinks of as a draftsman. I mean, that is a drawing of my father's. I mean, Ronald wouldn't draw like that. It would be, I've got a Ronald Searle drawing hanging in the hall, and it's just a thin pen line, you know. He just didn't draw like that. And my father's idea was fairly academic, I think, in regard to drawing. Anyway, one of the things I was going to tell you about, which I think will interest you, is that I developed a reputation, which I've only thought about in recent years, actually, of organising, theft on a sort from the Japanese. And it all started, really, in Singapore, because the Chinese used to come up to where we were working, and if you had a decent Japanese guard, they would allow you to buy from the Chinese, because we got a small amount of pay, and anyway, some of us had some money. And what they were selling us was our own food, which they had looted, like tins of bully beef and so on. And by and large, they were quite reasonable in their price, but there was one particular day when this Chinese fellow arrived, and he had got a basket with a number of objects in, and I walked over and asked him how much things were, and he was going totally over the top. I mean, he was charging us about three times the normal. So I thought, well, this isn't good enough. So I counted the number of articles in the basket, and there were seven, and I got six other chaps, and I said to them, now look, everybody pick up an object, and when I cough, walk away. You can't chase more than one, you see. So they agreed to do this, and I coughed, and everybody walked away with whatever they had in their hand. And I glanced over my shoulder, and there was a period of about 20 seconds where the Chinaman was so taken aback, he couldn't believe it. And then suddenly he started to leap in the air and scream and shout. And the Japanese guard came over and kicked his bottom, not very hard, and told him to clear off. Now, that may sound awful, and I suppose in retrospect it probably was, but he was going over the top. I mean, where they were charging us maybe two Singapore dollars for a tin of bully beef, he wanted eight or something like that. And later on, I organised a raid on the food store at the hospital, and when I think back on it now, it was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my life, but at the time I didn't think of it like that. The food store was the old nurse's quarters, and it was an isolated building surrounded by trees. The back of it had a very high hedge and then a malarial drain. And I watched the guard who were guarding this store, and I noticed it took them about 6 minutes to go around the building, and they met and then walked back again. So I organised a fellow called Fletcher, who was in my own section and a bit of a rogue, and a corporal of the Royal Corps of Signals, and one other person, I can't remember their names, and we managed to get two screwdrivers, and we still had a watch, and we practiced this in the camp until we got it absolutely perfect. And what we did was, we ran forward, and it was a padlock and hasp, you know the sort of thing I mean.
Yes.
And we screwed it off. And when we screwed it until the screws were nearly out, but left them all just in. Well, all that was quite easy, because while you were screwing, you were counting, and we knew we were working within a safety margin. We knew they took 6 minutes, so we worked three. But the big test came, and we each did this in turn, when you had to run forward, take all the screws out, open the door, pick up a crate, come out, put the hasp back on and just push the screws in gently and then go back to the high hedge and get into the malarial drain. Now, we worked this out in the camp till we got it down to about 4 minutes to do it. We practiced it. And we had to guess some of it because we didn't have a padlock and things like that to do it with. We had to just sort of count. And to cut a long story short, we got four crates out. There was four of us. We got one each. Fletcher, who was the bravest one of us all, by mouth, came out with a crate of cream, the last thing we wanted. But however, that's beside the point. And we then stayed there and screwed the thing back on again. And we then took it down into the malarial drain and pushed it under not exactly a bridge, but where the road came over the malarial drain, there was a tunnel. We pushed it under there.
A culvert.
A culvert, that's the word I want. And for 2 or 3 days, we took back 3 or 4 tins at a time, stuffed in our shirts and things like that. And then suddenly, Fletcher got fed up with this and said, we're never going to get it all back like this. And he just lifted a crate and marched down into the camp with it, bowed to the guard and went in, and nothing was said. The following day, we decided we'd take what was left. When we got back, it had all gone. Someone had found it and pinched it. So that was that. Now, I was court-martialed for that because our sergeant major decided that we were looting. And I was eventually marched up in front of the camp commandant. And the particular sergeant major had about the foulest mouth I've ever heard on anybody. He couldn't put two words together without he used an oath of some kind. And the officer that... Kendrick, that's right. Major Kendrick. He actually took the court-martial. And he said to me... You know, he asked me if I had anything to say in my defence, and I said, well, first of all, can't see why I was looting, because it was our rations I was stealing back again, and I thought that everything one could possibly do to harass the enemy was quite legitimate. And he said, well, that is a good defence for yourself, but he said, you were the senior rank of the four people involved, and he said, if you want to risk your own life, you're quite entitled to do so. But under no circumstances must you ever risk other people's lives on something quite so stupid, because the value of what you actually acquired was very small in comparison to the risk that you actually took. And he said, the whole point I'm trying to make is, he said, you must show an example. And he said, it's pointless, you swearing at a man and then wondering why he swears back at you, which was a lovely crack at this son major, you know, who'd put me on the charge. So I was admonished. But it didn't stop me doing it. I mean, I did it all through my prison life. And when we were at Tarsau, I organised a marvellous group of guys. And when the Japanese stores used to come up, because they're... actual administration was pathetic. I mean, I don't know whether they had quartermasters, but they never checked in quantities because they never missed anything. And as we were bringing it up from the river, we had about 200 or 300 yards to bring it up. And there was a very steep bank to start with, and then you carried it. It was sort of cutting through the jungle. And I used to organise a group of the sick men who weren't working to go down to the river to wash, only not to walk on the track, but to walk just inside the edge of the jungle. And we'd be bringing the stuff up. We would take it from the barge, or they weren't barges, they were rafts, really. You'd take it, you'd go a few yards and hand it to the next man, and he would go a few yards. It was a chain. And every now and again, I would sort of give a signal, and one of these packages, it might be cigarettes, it might be all sorts of things, would be thrown into the jungle for the sick men to take away and hide. And the thing that was amazing was the Japanese never missed it. They never missed it.
Could I come on to your own method of working in the camps in your drawing work?
Yes.
Did you have a routine, or did you just grab the chance when you could?
Well, initially, while we were working, while I was actually working, I never actually worked on the railway. I worked on the feeder road to the railway. They had to build a road.